We also have our hearing amendment, but it was that, or I didn't ask for it.
No, not that point, I couldn't, the amendment was added down.
Yeah, we had discussed, yeah, that's what I meant.
Well, I don't think the damage is necessarily relevant.
Oh, the value, whether or not damaged, is that what you...
Yeah, really, what someone is doing, who takes an automobile with something less than the intent to permanently deprive the owner of its use, in other words, to temporarily deprive him of its use, what he's doing is tampering. He's tampering with that ownership interest, just like in any other criminal mischief situation.
Dan, one of the, I guess the reason this approach was, is that people have testified, Phil, that when you're deprived of the use of your car, you're deprived of the use of the car regardless of the value of it, and that it's not, it shouldn't be based on the value of the car. To be, the offense is depriving you of the use of the car, and regardless of its value.
My feeling is that it will become extremely difficult for us to obtain convictions in a lot of situations that would be covered by the statute, where, one, we have a clunker involved, and two, you have a defendant who very clearly took it under what I think a lot of people would agree are non-felonious circumstances.
What would happen in that case? You wouldn't prosecute them?
No, we might be very well be in a position of having to prosecute, but I expect you see the same kind of result there as you see in situations where, in the Midwest recently, wives have been prosecuted for murder, where there's been a 10 or 12 year history of abuse involved. You've got a thing of jury nullification. I don't frankly think a lot of juries would convict for some facts that would arise under this statute as broad as it is. I can tell you, as long as I'm in the position I am, I'm flat not going to prosecute for the kind of situation I described where I borrow Barry's car. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a civil deal between Barry and myself and not a proper subject of criminal law in the first place.
You may want to isolate.
I don't think it even belongs to me. I don't think it ought to be a crime. If Barry loans me his car and we've got an agreement about the extent to which I use it, you know, and if I deviate from that, you know, I just don't think that the public as a whole has an interest in seeing tax dollars spent in prosecuting.
Are you talking about subsection 2 basically, Dan?
I think
you can deal with that with a one sentence defense provision in this amendment.
Subsection 3 is a felony on the books now.
Well, when you're dealing with a car rental agency,
well,
basically, okay. We're dealing with a rental agreement and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't know if we're looking at the rental agreement.
Yeah, I don't think it's between parties. But
well, you know, as to your point about 2 and 3, you could, of course, isolate 1 and just keep subsection 1 as a felony,
sure,
and 2 and 3.
Sure, you could. My point there would be that you're including an extremely broad range of conduct. You're including the kid that jumps in the car and drives it around the block.
I think that's what we want to do.
Well, that may make sense if it's keyed into mischief and it has some relationship to the value of the automobile. I frankly just don't believe that any jury that I'm going to take a case to charging a felony where a kid has jumped in a car, driven it twice around the block, and left it in virtually the same place is going to convict.
Well, I think that they're ready to do that now based upon the enormous number of dealing with and how this crime has been soft pedaled in the past. I think that the public is prepared to get tough on this kind of theft.
I understand why you think that, Mr. Clayton. Fortunately, there frequently is not a lot of relationship between the public and jurors. That's been my experience. What the public wants and what sort of majority of people who think about what the public wants, perceive they want, is not what happens when you get a case in front of a jury.
Mr. Knight, are we ready to vote on this issue?
Sure.
Being quarterbacked.
I will vote for the amendment. However, I will also seriously consider amending the amendment if later is appropriate to leave 1 as a C felony and make 2 and 3 misdemeanors. I would not have much difficulty with that amendment, although I tend in the direction of Mr. Carpenter. It's really frustrating.
Brad, if you're going to move to make amendment, have 2 and 3 to the 8 misdemeanors, I think we should do it at this time, or at least do it today. You're not going to want to do that.
I think Dan makes an important point, though, about 2 and 3, about treating that perhaps lower than 1, in the sense that...
I will move that amendment to the amendment, Mr. Chairman, because there you're starting from a situation where they already have legal custody, which turns into illegal custody of the vehicle. That's very different from the situation where it might well be actually theft, but you can't prove the intention to deprive, which now ends up being a misdemeanor, and that's the frustration that the public has, that the Carpenter's referring to, in my opinion. So I will move that amendment to the amendment.
Okay, well, discussion on you don't think the word reasonable or unreasonable is strong enough in that. I'm thinking of the guy that's number 3 on line 20. There seems to be a point when what does become theft, you know, and I think the word unreasonable, what protection do I have if someone asks me to borrow my car and he just doesn't ever take off with and goes to the state to ask you a lawyer and sue him or something? Or is that theft? When is it, you know,
well, this is
permanently deprived and all that, we're not using that language, but if it's an unreasonable thing, I'm not sure that shouldn't be a problem. You take a guy's car and he can go beyond an unreasonable.
Well,
Mr.
Chairman, I think the response there is that if somebody's taken the car and has actually taken it outside, you rise to the level of an intention to deprive, and you may be able to prove theft. Which would, in this situation, be a C or a B felony.
C. It's going to have to be a very expensive car for it to be a B felony.
What about that? We're talking about, I just know in circumstances where the behavior will tell you, say, well, wait a minute, you gave consent, if you just don't like where he drove it. You know, that's between you and him, even still, if you don't like the guy, maybe you told him he could drive it, so you can't charge him to steal the car, you can steal the car.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what Mr. Hickey's indicated, and I think what might be true with regard to at least some other prosecutors, is that if the amendment doesn't pass, and if that pick-pack situation, the prosecutor will be stuck with taking a case to a jury as a felony that they're afraid the jury will just nullify because they don't think that kind of an extreme treatment ought to apply. Rather than have some prosecutorial flexibility here, and that's what the amendment seeks to do, with and still reaching the situation of the what most people think of the joyriding, the frustration that people have with regard to the facts described by subsection 1.
Mr. Carpenter, I think I need some clarification on 2. I think I could possibly go with 3, but I'm not certain about 2. Having custody of a propelled vehicle under an agreement between himself or another person in the owner.
I guess what that's referring to is I'm the garage attendant, and I'm the attendant, and then there's someone working underneath me who's fixing the car. And I may give the person that's the mechanic custody after I got custody from the car owner.
That's what I think it means too. I wouldn't I'd keep that in a class with 1. I think a case can be built for a lesser degree on number 3. And I'd urge the maker of the motion to
consider that. Yeah. Or the garage attendant notices that it's a real nice, good-looking car, so he takes his girlfriend out on a date, and, you know, is that felony conduct?
It's as much felony conduct as number 1.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I will entertain that suggestion. I will change my amendment. Three as an A misdemeanor, and 1 and 2 as C felonies.
Yeah, may I make just an observation? Under existing law, as I think Dan pointed out, on line 15, having custody of a propelled vehicle under an agreement, Dan pointed out that it was just rental-type agreements, and I believe he's correct in the sense that existing law refers to a written agreement.
That's broader than that.
Exactly, the proposal is broader. What I would suggest, perhaps, is that you add the word written on line 15, and then, again, keep it all, if it's a written agreement, well, then that's existing law, and it is a felony under existing law. As to situations where Dan would loan me his car and it's a friendship-type loaning, I think you should deal with that as either theft or, you know, criminal mischief. So
maybe we should strike 3.
Well, no, I think you may want to,
as written.
This is a car rental agreement where I rent the car for.
Where you're running. Yeah, see, if you add written, you'll get existing law, which refers to written agreements, and you'll exclude the example Dan gave, for example, friendship type thing. I agree, I think that a lot of times that's civil, you know, that's maybe a civil instance.
May I ask a question, Mr. Chairman, of that, Mr. Chairman? What's the parallel? Okay, three really, if it really is intended, or we make it refer only to those written agreements.
Yes.
I think it's then parallels the theft of services. Now, usually, theft of services, say, from Hertz.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I suppose the argument is, can we delete it, and then it can be covered by theft of services?
Yes, you could, but here's what it does. But see, theft of services is tied into the value of the services. This is saying anytime you have the car and you, it's an unreasonable deviation, regardless of whether it was, you know, $15 or $100, will be a felony.
Okay, well, what is the dollar limitation between misdemeanor and felony and theft of service? $150?
No, it's the same thing as theft. It's
up to $500?
Yes.
Okay. Having not rented a car, since I don't drive.
I'm sorry. It's $500 between felony and misdemeanor.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, having not rented a car much, if I go to Hertz rent a car, how much do I have to use it in order to run up a bill of $500? Today?
Oh, no. You have to use it for about a fair amount of time.
$25 a day.
Well, I don't know.
Depends on how far you drive.
Let me tell you this. We had a criminal code hearing in Fairbanks that rented the car for 2 days and ended up costing $100, so whatever happened.
So then we're making a policy decision, or affirming a policy decision, that this kind of theft of services is more serious, or at least substantially different from other theft of services if we make it a felony.
And you also must prove, number one, you intentionally withheld possession, that it was an unreasonable deviation, which may be viewed as a little more difficult elements than under theft of services. I do want to keep them all as felonies.
Okay, although I'm not entirely in agreement with that result, Mr. Chairman, in the interest of comedy and the direction I think the committee is going, I'm going to withdraw my amendment. The amendment to propose a different one, to simply insert the word written before agreement on line 15 with the understanding that the commentary would compare that to existing law.
Yeah, Fred, just one clarification. Existing law refers to an agreement in writing. I refer to written. I'm going to just see which is the best for you.
Yeah, that's a set of law amendments.
Yeah.
Okay, the amendment is line 15, have the word written after, and a written agreement. All those in favor?
Thank you.
All those in favor of the amendment to the amendment,
which was changed while you were out in the hall.
No. Add written.
You heard it?
That was amendment still.
No,
to add the word written.
I read it
open up before agreement. Okay. All those in favor of the amendment, raise your right hand. Okay. Amendment 370. All right. The main amendment as amended is before us. Ready for a question?
Yep.
All those in favor, raise your right hand. Okay. The amendment carries 7-0. Okay. Now we are down to the last.
This is Chuck.
Okay, this is what I was
trying to that passed out, Chuck. This is the sex. Oh, this is the Randy Phillips Memorial Sex Bill.
Randy, don't pay.
I know.
I'm sorry, for the gallery,
Randy,
we have one extra copy.
Now, I want to have shown on the record that ever since Mr. Phillips delivered some magazines here for today to observe in the context of this amendment, they've been studied thoroughly. And his
ass.
Let's come back to it. We talked about this amendment before, and this deals with transportation or distribution of minors of any material, pornographic material, that involves minors as being used in the pictures. Okay. What when we got into the issue of whether this was constitutional or not, we were involving that New York, maybe it was a U.S. Supreme Court
case. No, it was a federal district court case in New York.
Okay. And one conclusion of the case was that it probably would be constitutional if it was classified as not a felony, and hence this one is classified as an A misdemeanor. Now, this will be the second provision. The other provisions, which is a felony that we already have adopted, deals with the question of anybody that's actually hiring or using minors in the state of Alaska to make these kinds of materials.
That's in the bill here.
Right. And this amendment, this section would only deal with people who are transporting or distributing, selling these materials. So in other words, this would deal with somebody that's exporting it into the state and then selling it here. We've already dealt with the question of somebody manufacturing this kind of material in Alaska.
Okay.
Ms. Beckwith.
I wish we had something in there about 16 years of age. How are you going to prosecute a guy? How are you going to prove that a guy knew the material he was transporting was 16 years under 16
years? Yes,
is that unreasonable?
Yeah, well, that's exactly the culpability that's required. It's important you brought that up. Under the general rules of culpability, after a circumstance, and a circumstance would be the age of the children, all the seller would be reckless. So that's
okay.
So in other words,
that is that it was clear that he didn't care whether the child were above or below 6 feet.
He had it in a reckless manner.
Yeah, that's correct. When you don't have one in here, then that's the.
It originally drafted.
That sounds like, okay. The second question was, what was this about? If the felony is unconstitutional, misdemeanor,
no, I didn't.
Did someone say that? Did you say something about it?
That was one of the points brought up in that federal case. Obviously it wasn't cut and dry.
I wonder if there's more discussion about whether that should at least be a seed colony to people to do this, if we're going to do it.
Okay. Maybe Barry could discuss exactly what the case said.
Yeah, well, the important thing about this act, I think I've done this a number of times.
Mr. Chairman, can somebody move the amendments or where they're going?
I'll move it.
I guess the important thing about the statute is that it prohibits the sale of certain depictions of conduct. And there's no requirement here that the thing that they're depicting be necessarily obscene. In other words, it's not required that there be a finding that the, for example, that the penetration that you're depicting is appealing to someone's pure interest or, you know, would fit the general rules of what obscenity is. So, at least in this one New York case, which is interpreting the New York statute, and the important thing to note here is that these laws are all very new, within the last year or so. In this case, they said that they strongly hinted that the application of felony penalties to prohibited non-obscene material, distribution of non-obscene materials would be unconstitutional. After I drafted the statute, I went back and looked at our existing law on obscene conduct. And it was very interesting to note there, and that's the closest thing we would have to that the penalty for the sale of obscene comic books, or however you want to call it, is only 30 days. So if I had looked at that statute previously, I probably would have recommended only B misdemeanor for this compared to our treatment in existing law. And that's a fairly recent statute that I've seen in comic book. Again, it was a 30-day maximum sentence. So. Well, specifically limited to comic books.
To obscene.
Well, it's also other type of conduct.
Oh, no.
You know, weird comic
books. Comic books.
The thing that interests me about this proposal, about the proposal we've already adopted, is that it's limited to sex with children, or among children, if you will. And that is the area that I feel we should be acting in and protecting children. So that interests me. Now there was something else very good that made me think. I can't recall it.
Chairman, I'm in favor of the amendment because it is limited in such a way that I think it's constitutional. In another way that has not been discussed here, and that is that here we're specifically dealing with commercial activities. That is, we're regulating commerce. is saying if he transports, distributes, or sells or attempts to sell. And I think that that can take care of what might otherwise be constitutional defects. I'm going to suggest, first I'll ask Barry if there would be any technical problem, without regard to policy, but a technical problem, if we were to have another subsection C that does, like in other statutes, it says, for the purpose of subsection A, each sale of any listed item constitutes a separate offense. To make it clear that you can prosecute for 20 counts of this, even if it's still an A misdemeanor.
Yeah, I guess the only problem with it is that we would do it here, and we wouldn't do it anywhere else in the code. And there's something to be said for, not having a specific reference in the statute.
Well, Mr. Chairman, otherwise it could be unclear. A prosecutor or someone else could read this, and it's not clear whether the crime is the scheme and the distribution or transporting of a bunch of them, or each transaction. And I would think that that somebody is committing a lot more serious activity if he's selling 2,000 of these things than if it's one 19-year-old selling it to a 16-year-old and selling one.
So is it?
That's why I can understand this distribution portion, but the transportation means that if I found to acquire some of this material and he packed around in his briefcase, he would be he had no intention of selling it.
No, it's specifically directed on line 7. Yeah. He transports or distributes for sale, yeah. Sells or attempts to sell.
That applies to both words.
Okay.
That's transporting for sale.
If any commercial trucker then transported these materials.
I'm still not satisfied with my question why we can't take this detail. Did anyone answer that question?
You can.
Well, then I'm going to offer the amendment.
Which brings back the main amendment between Mr. Brown.
Chairman, I'm going to I'm gonna see if this will work. I'm actually gonna move two parts of an amendment. If there's any question, we can divide it into two amendments to the amendment. That is, if there be a new subsection C saying, I give the language to Barry if he can put it properly.
Well, I've got it right here.
For the purposes of A, each sale of a list of any listed item constitutes a separate offense. And subsection D, that a second or subsequent offense, or whichever drafting method you mean, the second or subsequent offense or constitutes a felony.
Fred, just a point of clarification. Just the existing law, at least the county code section, refers to each day during which a violation continues as a separate offense. Now you say each sale is a separate offense. I would assume you apply, I mean, are you just want to apply the sale? Because we do refer to sale drafting orders.
Yes, I understand the problem, Mr. Chairman, and that is that section covers transactions that covers things that are not sales. That is, he distributes for sale but does not sell, or he transports for sale and you're able to prove that but doesn't successfully sell. Then I think that the provision for the purpose of A, each sale of any listed item that constitutes a separate offense just wouldn't apply.
Oh, okay, fine.
See, it just wouldn't apply to that situation, but it would apply to the situation where there really is are successful sales. And then there would be another provision saying the second or subsequent conviction subsequent offense would be a C felony rather than a misdemeanor. I so move.
Mr. Hickey, I have three very brief comments. The first goes to Mr. Brown's amendment. I think you probably need to deal with the question of whether or not, if you're going to do that, you want two sales right together with that intervening conviction giving rise to the felony offense. In other words, that might take place 5 minutes apart or 30 seconds apart, for that matter.
Oh, I see. Well, I think the intent of the amendment is a second or subsequent offense or simultaneous offenses.
Or
what? You know, if there's any question in the law in that regard, I don't know if there is.
If, for example, I charge someone with two counts,
would
one to be a misdemeanor and one to be a felony? And assume he had no prior offenses, and both counts alleged that on such and such a day, on the 10th day of March, 1977, X sold these books. Sold two books. And I put them in separate counts and put one to undercover officer X and one to undercover officer Y.
I think it's just pointing out somewhat, the confusion that can be caused by adding a provision of each sale as a separate offense. I would think that the court is any stat, interpreting any statute would determine, does a second violation of it, could we die for that? I don't think it's...
Yeah. Well, even with that language, if that language is in or out, you still have to deal with that question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, does Mr. Stern believe that without the provision saying each sale transaction is a separate offense, that the court would interpret this provision that way anyway?
Well, it would probably interpret it strictly. In other words, give meaning to its language and say that if it was the second time you were convicted.
No, we were not regarding the felony thing.
You sold it tomorrow, is that two?
That's two offenses, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, without the language.
I sold it to Sam Jones and Bill Smith, 5 minutes apart in two different places. Without my amendment, would that be prosecuted as two counts or one count?
In the same place, it would be two counts. Although I could charge it.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chairman, if the reporter to the commission and the chief prosecutor are convinced that's the case, maybe we just ought to put the intent of my subsection C in the commentary, and I'll just reduce my amendment to simply that a second or subsequent offense constitutes a C felony, and ask Mr. Stern to be artful about addressing the problem raised by Mr.
Hickey. You say the second conviction is a C felony? Or a second offense?
Second offense, because offense means, there's no conviction, there's no offense.
Well, you have to also deal with the question whether the felony offense is X sold having been previously convicted of the offense of sale. In other words, where you make the prior conviction an element of the second offense. That's an issue that has to be dealt with.
Well, I'm talking about conviction.
Okay.
Okay, but do you want it to be as an element or is it as a sentence?
He wants it to be as an element.
It has to be an element if it raises it to a C felony.
I understand the intent.
The two other provisions. One, it seems to me that there's no reason to restrict the offense to transportation. That's kind of a difficult concept, and if you're going to include that...
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that isn't germane to my amendment to the amendment.
I'll let you bring that. Okay. Friend, I just have one question. Why are we doing it here when we don't do it anyplace else? Why are we doing this for this particular agency?
No, Mr. Chairman, are you talking about each sale constitutes a
offense? No, the fact that this guy... when he commits this act the second time, if he's convicted the first time, it becomes a C felony. We have 100 other A misdemeanors, and we don't do that for them. Why the distinction here?
Because you're addressing a rather broad range of conduct, an unusually broad range of conduct with this, without dividing it into degrees, and yet it would seem to be silly to have first, second, and third degree transportation or distribution and so forth.
We're talking about the second time he's convicted. The second time he's convicted may be less serious than the first time, and yet you're going to get him for a C felony the second time. And somebody may have a very serious offense the first time, you're going to get him for an A misdemeanor, but because this guy's been convicted the second time, it's automatically a C felony. I don't understand why we do it for this offense and why we don't do it for other A misdemeanors that cover broad ranges of conduct.
Well, I suppose we could go from the bill and have a laundry list argument as to whether or not there are a lot of A misdemeanors that describe broad conduct, or whether in fact we have divided a lot of kinds of offenses into degrees. I think we've divided a lot of kinds of activity into varying degrees, and we could either do as I'm indicating or have the first, second, third, and fourth degree of transportation or distribution of depictions of minors engaged in sexual acts, which seems a little silly.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to answer your question, Mr. Fred Brown, as it applies to me at any rate. The reason I would vote for this amendment is because I did vote to make it a C felony, and I think it should be a C felony. And if the only way we can get it to be a C felony is on the second conviction, that's
of course.
Okay. Wait, the language would be transportation or distribution of depictions of minors engaged in sexual acts is a Class A misdemeanor, and then transportation, etc. Is a Class C felony for the second in each subsequent offense, and that we use that language already elsewhere in the code.
And it would be clear for me in the commentary and definitions by offense we mean that there have to be
that's correct.
Okay.
Yes,
you're about Carpenter.
I'm opposed to the amendment because unlike the guy who spoke up,
thank you, Mr. Carpenter.
Better haul bills or we're going to tie votes.
Are you saying that you are, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Are you saying you're approving all of these funding?
No. All main misdemeanors.
Okay.
That's way out over there.
Yeah, I think. I thought if it's just something that happened in the last 4 years.
I was just having a hard enough time today. And to think that this is in the code right after interference with constitutional rights.
Well, I suggest that it would go into miscellaneous offenses because I wasn't too sure exactly how I would want to put it in between tobacco.
While we're waiting for Mr. Miles,
he's
going to
vote against this.
He had a medical form. Let's take a straw vote.
That's not fair.
Straw vote.
What do you mean?
I didn't vote against it. Let's take
the straw vote.
Straw vote.
Straw
vote. We need Miles.
Yeah.
All right. How many are going to vote for this Fred's amendment?
You got it.
Okay, well, let's go ahead.
Let's make this a real vote.
How many are in favor of this Fred's amendment? Or how many opposed? Okay, motion carries 4-2. Miles is meaningless, isn't it? That brings the main amendment before us. Okay. All those in favor
of the main
amendment. Mr. Hickey.
Transportation for purpose of sale provision. Seems to me that if you're going to have that, it should simply be possession for purpose of sale. I don't understand what you're
possession?
For purpose of sale.
The reason we include transportation is because in Mr. Phillips' bill, which was done by legislative affairs, they used the term transportation.
Okay.
I was directed to.
My comment as a prosecutor is that's extremely restrictive. And it's not used anywhere else in the law that I know of, certainly in our statutes. And what we would use is possession for purpose of distribution. My second comment is, as I read the language of subsection A, even though the circumstance, which is the fact that the child has to be under 16 years of age, is something that the seller would have to be reckless to, you would still have to prove that, in fact, the child who is depicted in the book is under the age of 16. Now, unless Mr. Stern disagrees with that analysis, my question is, why not put in there that depicts a child who appears to be under the age of 16? What I'm going to tell you is that as long as you require that we prove that the child is under 16, what I'm going to do when a police officer brings me a case that says, all right, here's a book that X sold to Y that depicts a child under 16. I said, well, how do you know this child is under 16? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? I said, well, does it say so here and there?
course it doesn't say so. So I'm going to say, well, goodbye, Mr. Officer. You come back when you find out exactly who this child is and how old this child was at the time this picture was taken. Now, that child is probably going to be in New York or Florida or California or somewhere else.
Let me, and I'm telling you
that as long as it's like that,
okay.
I don't think the committee should be misled. There will be no cases prosecuted unless that police officer can prove to me beyond a reasonable doubt that that child who is depicted is under the age of 16.
Now, let me respond to Mr. Hickey. Of course, this amendment, this whole purpose of this section here was to protect children, under 16. So hence, the bill would require that the person in fact be under 16, because we have made a determination that we're not particularly concerned about protecting children over 17 or 18. I don't believe either that I've changed the wording in your bill. Secondly, I think if you make it so that the person reasonably appears to be over 16, you're leaving the door open to certain possible abuse of the statute by law enforcement, simply because I think that in this type of conduct, I think the argument could be made, well, the person does reasonably appear to be under the age of 16, and I'm sure that one of the selling points of some of quote, girly magazines is that they try to do that. And I think that by not requiring actual proof of the age, I think you're leaving the door open to interference with, I think, First Amendment rights.
I'm suggesting you make the jury question whether or not the reasonable average juror would conclude that that child who's in that book is under the age of 16.
And I think that the important point is that the purpose of this is to protect children under 16, not to protect necessarily children that may look under 16, or prosecute a bookseller who sells a book that doesn't contain someone under 16, but yet that person may look under 16. Well, I disagree because I think one of the purposes of what we did was to number one, make it a crime to, in this state, photograph that type of conduct. So let's assume in the situation the code passes and you have a statute that says it's unlawful to photograph minors under 16. Okay, then you get a tip and you know that there's this place where they're doing the photography. You have to get a search warrant, you make the arrest. In fact, you find people there under 16. You find out what magazines they were using, you find out what children they were using, what their ages were, then you find out who in Alaska was selling it, and then you make your case. So I think Mr. Hickey's point is, if you want to use the statute to go into bookstores and see whether you can make a case because they're carrying girly magazines, I think you would do the amendments Mr. Hickey suggests. If you want to protect the children under 16, I suggest you move the statute as it is.
Is there any amendments?
Because any amendment that goes in the direction that Mr. Hickey's been talking about and the debate here in this law could very, very carefully, just by a different choice of words, hang the bill or the statute or the amendment constitutionally or not, depending on how it was drafted. We don't have any language here. Why don't we go ahead and vote on the amendment, but without prejudice to coming up with an amendment along the lines of Mr. Dankler's been talking about, when we've got something carefully written and it's sitting right there in writing and we've had a chance to talk about it. Because if we start limiting that, just do some markup at 5:05 in the afternoon, we may be crossing the constitutional bridge, in my opinion.
We sure won't reserve the right to come back and work on some language. I think there is something out there we can use.
I'd be willing to listen to the arguments, but I would vote against any such amendment right now until I had a chance to see it and think about its constitutionality.
All right, the amendment before us then is this amendment as amended by Mr. Brownsmith. All those in favor of the amendment, raise your right hand.
This is the main amendment.
The main amendment. All those opposed, same sign. Motion carries 5-1.
Hey, do you want to be on record on voting for or against the Kitty Horn?
Any misdemeanor C. Horn?
For the Kitty Horn bill.
She's another vote, yes.
Okay, we'll record that 6-1. This is done. We'll record the minutes. While we're sitting here, we're going to start assembling now. Does anybody want to get a sandwich or lunch?
How long's the recess, sir?
5 minutes.
Okay.
We're calling meetings to order. The record reflects none of the Republicans are here. All right, we're going to start. We're through all the amendments on the code. We're going to start the sentencing now. I told Mr. Rubenstein that we would listen to him talk about the idea of establishing some system for sentencing guidelines. Mr. Rubenstein.
Yes, I think it would be a very good idea if the legislature encouraged the courts to establish some system of sentencing guidelines to cover first offenders. The absence of first offenders is one of the biggest areas which the sentencing provision does not touch. More than half of people will get sentenced for first offenders, and yet it's very difficult to come up with any kind of cut and dry absolute rules that would apply fairly logically all first offenders. So I think this is an area where the court really ought to get together and start slowly putting together some rules that would apply in these cases. And I think that with a little bit of encouragement from the legislature in the form of a resolution, it would be very helpful. And it would help, and the resolution might encourage them to develop their own rules with reference to the kinds of rules the legislature has developed for second and third offenders, so that eventually, over a period of time, you'd have a scheme which would harmonize all kinds of offenders under the same general considerations. So that you don't have a situation where the judges are dealing with one half of the people who are sentenced, which is the first offenders, in a way which is completely opposite from the way the legislature is dealing with the other half of the people who are being sentenced. And I think that it's good that the legislature is not getting into the first offender area, because I think that it's very difficult sitting around here in a committee room with limited time to come up with the kinds of rules that are going to work and be fair and be rational for such a tremendous different number of offenses and committed by people some of them may be hardened criminals who never got caught, some of them may be people on their way to lifetime 3 years of crime, and some of them may just be unlucky people caught in a clash of circumstances or just immature people. And I think that if you can't come up with fair rules to cover all these people, I think you should encourage the courts to do that. And it can be very easily done simply by taking the kind of language that Mr. Pope has used in his draft and putting it in the form of a resolution and letting the courts try it. Now, people have said, well, why can't the courts do it on their own? Well, they can. They can conceivably do it on their own. But for one reason or another, or a combination of reasons, there's been a real lack of any concerted effort by groups of judges to get together and try and talk about general policy and general direction for sentencing in the courts. Up until now, historically, in this state and every state that I know of, sentencing function has been a very individualized thing, judge by judge. No matter how conscientious each individual judge is, he's bound to differ from his brethren on the bench. And the result is a disparate pattern. And this is one of the things that your bill is trying to get away from. And I think that you're to be commended for the restraint that you've exercised in not trying to do too much at once, not trying to cover every offender with a blanket rule when the entire effort is basically experimental as far as the newness of this type of legislation. I think that you should leave the first offenders alone, pass a resolution, encourage the judges to go to work on them, concentrate your efforts on the repeat offenders. That's really all I have to say.
This was a bad day after the big
call. resolution to pass, and let's assume that that's what happened. But it would be a sort of a companion bill with the code, a resolution asking the courts, since we passed this bill, to address the question of first offenders.
Mr. Brown?
I have a question for, Mr. Lewis, that, I guess. Keep getting involved in this. Okay, this is on the assumption that this committee may well pass a sentencing scheme that does not include first offenders. It seems to be the direction we're going in. And if that's the case, but we still want to have this done, I'd really like to see something really happen rather than just have us pass a resolution. Now, probably we can't direct the courts to do something, but is it your feeling that we have the power through a resolution or a statute to direct the legislative council, the judicial council to do something? Because if we have the power to mandate the preparation of suggested standards rather than just suggested, I prefer to do that.
If you want to, yes, you have the power to direct the judicial council, because the Constitution says the judicial council just performs such other functions as the legislature may assign it. So that's clear. The question would be, what would the effect of it be on the courts? Now, if you directed the judicial council and then in the same paragraph, suggested strongly or directed that the council try to involve the courts, you might be doing something good. In other words, the judicial council can do all kinds of things, but they won't have to be, what would the effect of it be on the courts? Now, if you directed the judicial council and then in the same paragraph suggested strongly or directed that the council try to involve the courts, you might be doing something good. In other words, the judicial council can do all kinds of things, but they won't have any effect on Judge X's sentence or Judge Y's sentence unless Judge X and Y decide to work with the judicial council. So, I mean, some kind of appropriate combination of language would be in order there.
It seems to me that the problem of whether the Supreme Court would promulgate some sentencing guidelines as rules or not would be addressed very simply, that if you had a group draw up some sentencing guidelines, and then these were recommended to the Supreme Court, and they didn't do anything with them, the legislature might just decide to do it for them. And so maybe there's no reason why we have to say the Supreme Court did this or not. If they don't do something, then maybe next year, the year after, the legislature is going to take note of that and say, well, here's some really good sentencing guidelines. They haven't done anything with first offenders, so now we're going to do it for them.
We always have a record for it. To respond to that, the sentencing guidelines can be put together by the superior courts just because they want to do it, without any rule, simply because this is what they're following the sense of the resolution. Now, so then after this is done, it would be quite possible for the judicial council, the same way it's done so far, to review each and every sentence passed in the state of Alaska since the adoption of those guidelines. And then the legislature can just look at the sentencing patterns of pre-guidelines and post-guidelines and decide whether or not something effective has been accomplished, and take it from there. It's a many-step process.
Yeah,
Mr.
Jackson, you have
the next question.
Two questions. One is, of course, we spoke to this once before, and I have one question about putting this whole problem back in the court system to do this when we haven't decided whether we want to even include first offenders.
Okay. Just let me say one thing. It's my intention to listen to Mr. Rubenstein, and then we're going to hear from Mr. Hickey on this issue about whether we want to include first offenders. I'm not going to try to resolve the issue right this minute, so let's just ask Mr. Rubenstein a question.
Okay. The second question is, I haven't had any indication from the court that they want to do this.
Well,
Rubenstein is here with the judicial council saying that we want a resolution, that the courts want to do this. I'd like to hear it. And I guess the question for Mr. Rubenstein is there any indication from any of the courts that they, Mr. Snowden or anybody, that they want to do this, or are they opposed to this?
Okay, let me try and answer the question as accurately as I can. I know that Chief Justice Boutiefer is in favor of it because I discussed it with him several times before coming to you, of course. So that's some indication of court. I know that Mr. Snowden, of course, backs the same thing because I've discussed it with him, because he's aware of the Chief Justice's position on it, and I know he feels that it's right too, I mean, from his personal point of view. Now, I attended a conference in Seattle with Judge Moody, who's presiding judge in Anchorage, and Judge Compton, right here in Reno, yeah, Compton was there, and a few other Superior Court judges, and in the, during the conference, the purpose of the conference was the federal government was trying to get as many states as possible to adopt a guideline system like this voluntarily on their own without any legislation. And I had a lot of discussions, you know, just over drinks with the judges about it. And the general impression that I had from them was that they were interested. They were not, they didn't make any commitments, but I think that there's reason to feel that that the idea will not be met with hostility. I think that there are enough judges who are interested in this kind of thing, and you have some reasonable expectation that it would be done. And I think people would give it a good shot if they realized, especially if it was encouragement from the legislative branch.
Yeah. Mike, is it imperative, in your opinion, that the judges do this solely? The reason being, the criminal code has been worked on for a number of years by layman lawyers and judges. Why would it, you seem to be keep saying the judges do this, the judges do that. That's the problem that I have, narrowing it down to just judges creating their own guidelines. What would happen if a group similar to the Criminal Code Commission drew up these guidelines, and what kind of flack would they get from Judge X, who finds a particular problem with Guideline 4?
Well, okay, now, there's a federal bill in the U.S. Senate now, which does set up a special commission to put together guidelines like this. In California, they have a special commission to do it, which is the California Judicial Council. Now, it so happens that the California Judicial Council is judges, but it also has a little separate it's separate unto itself, but yet it's composed of judges. So, I mean, there are other ways of doing it. It doesn't have to be judges, but the advantage of judges is, one, you avoid creating a separate administrative agency of layers of bureaucracy, funding, so forth and so on. That's one big advantage. Two, if the judges do it themselves, it's more likely that it will have impact on them, because anything that happens in the courtroom, two attorneys and a judge can be unhappened, too, if you know what I mean. I mean, the two attorneys and the judge have so much control over what goes on in that courtroom that if they're very hostile to a particular idea or a proposal, it's not too difficult for them to find ways around it. I'm suggesting that if the judges themselves take it upon themselves to do this, they're more likely to act within the proper spirit. And I think that judges, after all, you know, we can make all kinds of proposals, but day in and day out, they have actual cases coming before them. And they agonize over those cases sometimes, and they realize their inaccuracy, and they recognize that the judge down the hall just yesterday did something dramatically different from what they did, and they wonder whether they're right. But they keep on seeing these cases and these facts.
Okay, all right, I hear what you're saying, but the question is, you know, is it reasonable to presume that the judicial system would go along with something other than what the judges put together without us mandating it by law?
I'm suggesting that you encourage it by resolution, not that you mandate it by law.
Okay, yeah, but how about a non-judge group, or a partial of judges, and some laymen, some lawyers?
We create a new group to do this. I mean, that's not unreasonable. I just suggest that it's more complex and expensive.
Okay, well, if that's the only reason, then I'm not sure. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I think that in the event that we do not go with first felons and presumptive sentencing, and I don't agree with that, I think we should do this. I think it should be done in a mandatory way. I think in order to avoid bureaucracy and the creation of new commissions, which is one of the reasons why I blew up the commission to recommend whatchamacallit in 661, that we direct the legislative council to do it with a resolution that also has a precatory clause relating to urging the cooperation and direct participation by the judiciary. And that's the way to fly. Without we creating something new, and then it's going to want to grow by itself and have a big budget next year and all this. Instead, Mike can come in and defend his budget, and you know, because they're supposed to do this kind of study anyway.
Well, I
need them
very concerned.
Yeah. That was a question I asked.
The end of the thought is that they're halfway and half this. Aaron, I'd like to.
The question that I'd ask you then, I've got the answer, is why don't the judges, if they all agree to do that, why don't they just do it? They don't need us to tell them or suggest they do it. They all discussed it over drinks. They've been to meetings. They know about it. Why don't, if they want to do it, why don't they just go do it? Why do we need this?
Well, first of all, I don't know that they all agree. I tried to indicate to you the extent of the agreement. agreement that I was aware of. So that's one thing. Secondly, I don't know why. I mean, why don't a lot of people in government do a lot of the things that would be a good idea if they did them without somebody prodding them? I mean, this is the way things work. It's not customary, it's not traditional, it's not the normal way of proceeding. Judges tend to be very independent and unto themselves, and they just haven't thought along these lines. And I'm suggesting you might encourage them to think along these lines. They might do it on their own.
What would happen, like, if you had this judicial council?
I would be delighted. I would like the judicial council to get into that. I mean, I've discussed this proposal with the judicial council members, and I think that probably a majority of them would go along with it. I think it's great, but I'm suggesting that it could be done that way too. Yeah, I would have no objection to that.
Is there any other questions?
Chairman, I know you want to go on to Mr. Hickey, and I just want to offer the comment that the reasons why it's difficult for judges to do this, why are we discussing a resolution that's not a bill?
Well, I think
I would like to...
That's a question. Do you have a question?
It's a thought I want to express now, and it involves what he just said. If we don't do it, then the judges are going to remain unto themselves, and they won't do it. They'll talk about it for years. If we go ahead and we at least put it in a resolution, maybe there's money attached and it's mandatory to the judicial council, and no, the legislature is getting very serious. Pickens have also passed presumptive sentencing as to repeat felons. And they're going to know they're kind of under the gun, that they're going to have to cooperate, and they're going to have to realize that the other branch of government is really concerned about this. So I guess that's the answer, Mr. Walters.
Thank you, Mr.
Rubenstein.
I
might
mistake because we'll be taking the issue.
This
is Mr. Hickey's draft of the sentencing.
Let me tell you briefly what that thing I handed you is and what it is. What it is a series of proposed amendments to 661 that would deal with the classification of offenses and the basic sentencing issues. What it does not include is the subject of probation or the subject of parole. The reason it doesn't at this point is, number one, because they're not finished, and number two, because I don't think that those two subjects can be dealt with in a meaningful way until you make some basic decisions about the sentencing scheme you adopt.
Then I might ask you, after the committee makes those basic decisions, which is going to be the day, are you going to go ahead then and present something on probation?
Right, I'll have that finished within a couple of days.
Okay.
Very briefly, on the subject of parole, I think that you do need to make a basic decision to include that subject in whatever overall scheme you devise. That if you're going to give any meaning to the concept of presumptive sentencing or sentencing reform in any way, you've got to address the subject of parole. That if the purpose of whatever sentencing scheme you devise is to establish A, some uniformity in sentencing, and B, some certainty and the elimination of disparity, that the subject of parole has got to be dealt with. If you leave it as it is, you in effect, in my judgment, lose anything you might have gained by revising sentencing procedures in the criminal law. On the subject of first offenders, and I don't want to belabor this point for a long time because one thing, it's late. Second thing, it's a subject to discuss at some length. I testified some weeks ago here at some length on this subject. I think really the issue resolves itself into three basic questions that you need to ask and answer. Number one, is it rational to exclude first offenders from a single comprehensive sentencing scheme? Number two, what is the effect of doing so, if you choose to do so? And number three, and ultimately, this is the issue, who is responsible for determining what an appropriate sentence for a particular offense is? My judgment on that is that a conclusion has been made by everyone that's been concerned with the subject of sentencing reform, is that the legislature needs to take a much more active role in assuming the responsibility that it has for fixing the sentences for offenses. Now, I've made a lot of prior arguments about first offenders, the fact that, that depending on how you define a prior conviction, you're going to exclude as many as 80% of all offenders, et cetera. But it seems to me that the really basic argument here is as follows. Number one, that in fixing sentence and sentence guidelines and narrowing the range of discretion that's to be exercised in a particular case, that responsibility is the legislature. And if you defer that to a court, whether by way of a resolution, by way of a recommendation that they make, they devise guidelines at some point in the future, you're basically simply ignoring that responsibility and deferring it to the courts. I think that to a large extent, the reason the issue is before the legislature is because it's been the judgment of a lot of people in the legislature and a lot of people in the executive branch of government that the courts have not done an effective job at narrowing their discretion in the past. The other thing is, and I think that building off of what Mike was saying, that if you don't do it, the courts are, whether it's through the vehicle of the Supreme Court with some kind of a rule apparatus, or through the Judicial Council, or through some separate commission of judges, or more importantly, what in my judgment is going to happen, is through individual judges. The effect, I think, of setting presumptive sentences for second and subsequent offenders will generally have the effect of, by implication, devising a system of presumptive sentencing for first offenders. And everyone will be trying to figure out what the hell it is and what the legislature meant by it. I think that what you'll have is, however many Superior Court judges you have, that's how many systems of presumptive sentencing for first offenders you're going to have. And however you define a prior conviction for purposes of determining a first offender is how many people in the system that's going to apply to. If you define first offender the way I think you ought to, it's going to apply to a lot of people, probably 80% of all felons. I think each judge will attempt to deduce, you know, what kind of a first offender scheme the legislature would have devised if it had gone the next logical step, past second and third offender. Pardon?
That's a pretty good idea.
For them to do that? I don't think so.
As opposed to just saying, well, I have full discretion as I had before the law was passed?
That it may have that effect, but I think that if the purposes of revising your sentencing scheme is to bring uniformity to sentences and certainty to sentencing, you're not going to achieve that. Because I can name you a judge in Fairbanks that when he tries to deduce what your first offender presumptive sentencing scheme is, it's going to be pretty severe, as severe as he can make it. There's going to be a judge here in Juneau, on the other hand, who's it's going to be as less severe as he can make it. But ultimately, I think you have to resolve the issue. Who's responsible? And in my judgment, the legislature is the proper body to be establishing an overall single comprehensive sentencing scheme that applies to everyone. And that's fundamentally irrational not to include first offenders in your scheme.
Mr. Mickey, on the issue of the first offenders, realizing that there have been several bills in the last few years submitted by the governor, is it officially the governor's position that he wants first felony offenders included in a presumptive sentencing scheme with mandatory sentences?
Yeah, I'm unfortunately not in a position to say that officially. At this particular point in time, it's the governor's position that's what he wants. I believe that will be his position as soon as I finalize this draft and run past it, as a matter of courtesy, bringing it to the legislature as the Department of Law Criminal Division's position on the matter.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hickey, how many, if any, how many jurisdictions right now have some kind of a presumptive sentence? Something that could be called a presumptive sentencing scheme of the sort we've been talking about.
I think probably under five.
And how new are those provisions?
All within the last 3 years?
Or two,
well,
or one?
Well, Mr.
Three,
Chairman,
3 years or less.
I think there's three states, 2 years.
That's right. Mr. Chairman, I think that addresses the so-called irrationality that Mr. Hickey raised, and that is that we're doing something that's brand new here, and we're doing it rather comprehensively as it is. I am definitely serious about the suggestion that we have we mandate the Judicial Council to come up with a system that would at least be persuasive, if not binding, on the judiciary with regard to first felons and perhaps even misdemeanors. But this is a brand new system, And I have been in favor of presumptive sentencing for repeat felons for 3 years, and I still am, but I'm just not willing to go that final step. And also, Mr. Chairman, all this talk about, well, we don't yet have the governor's approval, and here's yet another bill. This committee's been considering this legislation for all of our committee days except one or two that I know of since we started this session. I don't know how many we spent last year. Mr. Hickey was with us. He was also on the Code Revision Subcommission, and I, like he, have been ill for about the last 2 weeks. And reporters may make jokes about my absences or something, but Mr. Chairman, I think it's a little too late, and I also think that as a matter of policy, presumptive sentencing for first offenders might be a good idea to consider a separate bill after we have about 2 years of experience with repeat felons, and I might well be voting for it, but I'm not voting for it now.
Yeah, I just think it's important to realize, and I don't know which way this goes, but that I think that Mr. Hickey's proposal, in a sense, you're coming in here and saying you're going to apply presumptives to first. But if you take a look at the bill, you'll find on page 7, lines 13 through 20, subsection E, there's a very wide escape clause there, which I think is good, and you can apply presumptives to first, which essentially says if you haven't been convicted of a previous felony and the crime is not a violent offense, and there are no factors in aggravation or mitigation, you don't have to be sentenced to... You may suspend all the entire sentence. So that's a rather large category when you consider how many offenses we have in the code and how many of them are person crimes. The other thing is, if you turn to page 11, in terms of factors in aggravation and factors in mitigation, you see that this has been changed somewhat. And if it's a factor, if you're subject to presumptive sentence, and the presumptive sentence is 3 years, which would be what we now classify C or B felonies, you may decrease the presumptive sentence by not more than an amount equal to the presumptive sentence. So you can get out of presumptive sentencing for what we classify as C or B felonies for factors in mitigation. Now, this is not going to the point on whether you should have it or not. I'm just saying that Mr. Hickey's proposal does not say all first offenders shall be subject to presumptive sentencing. I think if you considered the amount of people that would fall in one of the exclusions, you'd probably get to come pretty close to our 70% figure we've been battered around.
Let me build on real quickly on the scheme is there. Pardon?
Is it a sham?
No, I don't think so, because I think that as a matter of policy, that's an appropriate scheme for first offenders. That's what the court should apply. Well, what it does, first of all, is that it adds an additional classification to the offenses. It adds what you've been talking about as a super A, and it makes that class A, which I would propose would include kidnapping, attempted murder, probably under your action today, second-degree murder, so it'd be attempted first-degree murder, kidnapping in the first degree, second-degree murder, and an aggravated forcible rape. And I think we can go into that in a separate context, why I think that's appropriate to elevate rape to that level. The Class B would include the remainder of the present Class A's. Class C would include your Class B's presently, and Class D, as proposed under this bill, would include Class C's with, I think, a couple of exceptions. For example, perjury is classified.
We reclassify that.
Taking care of that. All right. That's under this proposal would become a C. What the bill does is it sets presumptive terms for first, second, third, and subsequent offenders. Okay, three presumptive terms. Then it says, with respect to factors in aggravation, when the presumptive term that has been fixed by the legislature is 3 years or less, if you have a factor in aggravation, a sentencing judge may mitigate the sentence by an amount equal to the presumptive term.
If you have a factor in aggravation, you may
factor in mitigation. When you have a factor in mitigation present, the sentencing judge may mitigate the sentence by an amount equal to the presumptive term, which would get you to a suspended sentence. In other words, to zero, all right? In addition, it says under the escape hatch, when you have no prior felony, when you have no physical injury, when you have no deadly weapon, dangerous instrument being used in furtherance of the offense, and when you have no factor in aggravation present, then you can suspend, mitigate to zero with respect to all categories. Now, what that means is that under that escape hatch, even a Class A felony could, under those guidelines, be mitigated to zero in the discretion of the sentencing court. It also says that a first offense C felony, which is your present B, and a first, second, and third offense D felony, which are your present C's, could be mitigated to zero upon the establishment of a factory mitigation. So that's basically the scheme as applied to first offenders. It sets a presumptive term, and it provides that in the mitigated case it can go to zero, and it provides in the absence of those other factors it can go to zero, which it seems to me is the kind of scheme that you want a court to apply in making these kinds of considerations.
The great slight eating over there.
Okay, sir. I was going to argue that in support of Mr. Hickey, I think that Fred's argument can be turned around just as far as his argument, that why not go presumptive on first offenders, and a couple years down the road we could change that. That's just as logical as to say let's not, and a couple years down the road we could go presumptive on it. Secondly, as far as Barry's comment that there are holes in this amendment as big as the morning glory, that fortifies the position of going presumptive on first felonies, first offenses rather than the other way around. Without getting complex in my argument, I'll just have to say I agree with Mr. Hickey that it's irrational to set presumptive standards for couple of categories, not for the other. I haven't heard an argument that makes sense. And as for leaving any of this to the discretion of the judicial counsel, with all due respect, that's our job out there.
Excuse me, Larry, when I started my remarks, I think I prefaced it by saying I don't know which way it cuts. I was just trying to stress the fact that you are, in fact, barring presumptives for all persons.
Well, I don't understand what you mean by saying requiring presumptive. If I understand you correctly, you're using presumptive in the sense of mandatory minimum.
I guess that's correct.
And that's I think, inappropriate, because that's not what presumptive sentencing has ever been. Again, getting myself back to the basic point, what, in your judgment, is going to be the effect of eliminating first offenders? What is going to happen to first offenders? Has anyone here dealt with that issue? What's going to happen to them? What kind of a sentence are they going to get? To what extent are they going to be affected by the fact that you set a presumptive sentencing scheme for all other offenses other than first offense? And if so, if you have any idea how they're going to be affected, and do you want to have any input on how they're going to be affected?
That was the point I made the other day when this subject was up. I think the greatest abuse is with the first offender. I'd rather have presumptive sentences for the first offender than the second and third. There remains some logical abuse.
I would just soon complete Mr. Hickey's testimony, so if you have a question, Mr. Hickey, we'll take it, and then we can get to the debate. Mr. Brown, a question?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hickey said, well, what are you going to do with regard to first offenders? And we've discussed various things, and it's my view that the maximum sentence for a first offense can go above the presumptive sentence for the second offense when a certain extra showing is made, and I think we requested staff to play with that and come up with an appropriate bill. So we're not necessarily coddling them, if that's what you were asking.
In other words, you think that an aggravated first offense ought to be able to
a judge should have
higher than a presumptive second offense.
Level of the presumptive term for the repeat offense in the extreme case when there's some aggravation shown, in my opinion. And I don't know whether four votes here that say that, but that was one of the suggestions we had. We did discuss it, and we have talked extensively about first felons. So anyway, that was
okay.
A question.
Highlighting maybe what would be helpful is if I just sort of touched upon certain sections in this bill which I think deviate a little bit from what you had under consideration. I think you'll find that an awful lot of the language here.
About how long is your presentation?
No, I don't know. I mean, how long would you like to do?
you want an answer?
I can sit here and talk for 3 hours.
I have a meeting
at 7. Long enough to cover subject showing up to be in the
chair.
Right?
No, I mean, sure.
It's
just a legitimate question.
Yeah, I've got, probably 10 to 15 major points.
Okay, and how long is it going to take?
Well, if I go straight through them, probably 15 minutes.
Okay, I'll sit
for
15. We've got the whole goddamn sentencing bill to do, Mr. Chairman. We're going to try and do it tonight, and I kind of resent the 20-page amendment that the governor hasn't signed off on being presented.
Well, I apologize on behalf of myself and the governor for that, Mr. Miles. I can offer something in the way of an explanation as to why that occurred.
No.
If you'd like to, I can do that after the meeting. All right. Structurally, this proposed amendment recommends two changes to 661. One would be an amendment to the last portion of the substantive part of Title 11 that would add to the general provisions a new article called Classification of Offenses. And it basically takes what has been set out before, with the exception that it attempts to define Class A, B, C, D felonies, etc. In other words, it attempts to lend some rationality to why you're distinguishing between crimes. And I think that that language is largely self-explanatory. The second amendment is to add a new Section 25 to the bill to amend existing AS 1255, which is the chapter in Title 12 dealing with sentencing and probation, to have it include all of the sentencing provisions. Section 5 is the Declaration of Purpose Clause and is largely identical to what you've had under consideration, with the exception that it reorders the sentences to put what you had as the second sentence first, and changes the second a bit in that I think there was some inconsistency there in the way seriousness of the offense was used in the proposal that you previously had. And that is that arguably the purpose of presumptive sentencing and the purpose of the criminal code in structuring degrees is to already state and distinguish between offenses according to their seriousness. In other words, the very fact that you classify offenses distinguishes between them as the seriousness. And the fact that you're imposing certain presumptive sentences distinguishes between them on that same
page.
What
page are you on? I got you on.
I'm sorry, I'm on the bottom of page 2 and the top of page 3. Okay? It also uses slightly different language with respect to rehabilitation and reformation than you do, in that you talk about the likely effect which a sentence is going to have on reformation. Now, one of the problems I have with that is that it's become commonly recognized that an inappropriate reason to sentence someone is on the expectation that he'll receive rehabilitation while incarcerated. I think everyone in the business, if you will, agrees that that doesn't happen, and that people ought not be put in jail to be rehabilitated. People ought to be put in jail to be punished. Now, while they're in jail, every effort should be made to rehabilitate them. And I think that there's just a very subtle difference there that creates that distinction.
Dan, I would ask you to make one distinction in the testimony. We may or may not have made a mistake when the committee used the governor's bill as a draft in the sentencing. And many of the changes you just went over are changes from the governor's bill. And we have not deleted anything from the governor's bill in terms of these sections. We cleaned it up a little, both the suggestion of our staff and your staff. And I think that, you know, it's okay that you've done this, but I'd rather go through the issues that are, you know, a little more fundamental than you change, you know, reworking the governor's bill from last year.
Sure. All right. Section 11A is identical to virtually the last year, and to the one I understand you have under consideration.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, Dan, but what do you mean by when you say 11?
It means the last three digits of these.
Oh, 11. Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Okay,
page 3, section
11.
subsection B is a section that was in the governor's bill. Is a section I understand from Doug. You were of the view should be deleted. And I've reinserted it. The argument for its inclusion, I believe, is number one, that there are still going to be offenses where imprisonment is not provided for. There's certainly going to be a whole range of misdemeanor offenses to which they're applicable. It's particularly important if you do not include those offenders that language be included there. But in any event, there's no change from the governor's bill.
Why does that have to be in the misdemeanors?
Well, it has to be in there for, no, violations aren't involved because they don't involve imprisonment.
Yep.
It's in here for misdemeanors, and it's in here as basic statement of legislative policy as to when imprisonment should be imposed within the context of the presumptive sentencing provisions and guidelines that are set forth in the bill.
I never realized the purpose of that section, but that's in addition to times when you have to give a sentence of imprisonment
sure.
under presumptive sentencing.
Sure. It applies to those circumstances where judicial discretion is retained. And make no mistake about it, every bill that's been before you retains a considerable amount of judicial discretion. And certain basic statements of legislative policy have to be devised in addition to mandatory provisions, in my opinion.
Okay.
that apply to that, that discretion that's retained. And that's in a section that does. section 16 sentencing provisions is virtually identical to what you've been doing, and that's on pages 4 and 5. The heart of the presumptive sentencing provisions are in sections 26, 31, and 36 of the bill, and they're paid on pages 6 and 7. And you'll see that that it's recommended that a presumptive sentence be set for murder, but that they only be set for a first and a second murder. And that on a first murder, it be 30 years. On a second or subsequent murder, that would be 99 years. That's a presumptive sentence. And the definition of prior conviction would include, for murder, a prior Class A felony being restricted to those three or four extremely serious Class A felonies.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question?
Yes.
You went through the murder thing there, and I don't know if you were here. I guess you were here when we were talking about the right policy decisions on splitting murder with or without regard to, I guess without regard to whether all of this amendment were adopted. You mentioned a 30-year. Do you think that the mandatory minimum for the most serious murder one in the modern draft should be 30? I'd be suggesting 20.
No. This bill would have the effect of making it 15. It would be the mandatory minimum, which is present law for second-degree murder. I frankly don't.
Well, of course, present law is not really a minimum. That is, present law minimums make no sense because the judge always has the power to suspend or to make an SIS, even as to some of the extreme things.
Arguably not so with respect to murder, right? Under 1105 and 50.
Well, at any rate,
I don't know of a sentence for murder that's gone below 15 years.
Well, that's because we don't have totally erratic judgments,
right?
Right.
Yeah. I think that your amendment this afternoon can easily fit into this or whatever scheme you advise. I don't see any difficulty with that, even though I have problems with that amendment.
Yeah.
Again,
at first blush, there seems to be substantial differences. Felony sentencing in 297 of what you're proposing. Can you just capsulize the reason why?
Some of it is because of a real change in offenses that are being dealt with in terms of how they define the code and how they're broken out. For
change
example,
in defenses from when this was
defenses.
When this
was
offenses.
Offenses.
I'm sorry. Offenses.
You mean you think our markup has so substantially changed the definition of the offenses that justifies some massive change in sentencing?
No. Bill's talking about 297, which is based on existing law.
Which example do you think, for example, represents a radical change in what's?
Well, in your draft, you're setting out a 12-year sentence for a first Class A felony conviction.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in 297, for a first Class A felony conviction, the term is anywhere between 2 and 25 years. You're setting it at 12.
Okay.
Now that's
297 doesn't do that.
Yeah. But 297 had a separate presumptive sentence for each offense listed.
Oh,
yeah,
you're talking
right.
About
between 2 and 25 years.
Right.
Now your just the philosophical approach is completely different.
No,
I mean that's not because the definition of the offenses has changed, is it? Specifically,
no.
these examples, Dan. You give 10 years for manslaughter, which is a Class A felony. And so you would make it raise it to 12.
No, that
forcible
would become
rape.
6 under this bill.
What?
That would become 6 under this bill.
What he has is a B felony, is an A felony under the code.
With
a couple of exceptions.
Well, rape's only 8 years under here, under
right.
297.
Right. And rape under 297, in terms of its definition, includes a certain range of conduct that is broader than I would propose to include in a Class A rape.
Okay,
and
so
you're
reclassifying the crimes then from 297.
Some of them.
Yeah.
Some
well, them. It seems like a good portion.
Yeah.
They are being reclassified, and the terms, the sentences are changing also.
On some. Manslaughter is a good example. And I think that manslaughter, the change in manslaughter, reflects an adjustment in thinking about that offense, which I think Mike and I both agree on as a result of some studies conducted by the Judicial Council and by simply taking a harder look at those crimes.
Mr. Chairman? In the event that we don't happily embrace this entire amendment, which might well happen, I might might still be interested in some of this detail work with regard to particular offenses. I don't think that's out of order, because that's still not something we're going to firm up after we make policy decisions. So unless the chairman has a different view, after we go up or down on as a policy decision, are we going to consider something like this? I'm still going to be interested in some of this backup material just for the last of the markup after the policy decision. I don't see anything wrong with that.
Okay, Dan. What you'll see working here, in addition to the terms that are set out, the notion of the escape clause, which in the case of felonies is set out on page 7 in section 31E, is what Barry read to you, and the effective factors in aggravation and mitigation, how they affect these terms. And you'll see, for example, that the terms that are 3 years or less for a first class C felony conviction and for all levels of Class D felony convictions. Okay. In addition, it has the effect that for any first offense where there's no prior felony of any kind, the escape hatch, if you subsection E, if you have all of those factors present, no prior felony, no physical injury, no weapon, and no factor in aggravation, then you can suspend. The additional thing that's working there is a mathematical acceleration factor, which sort of holds true between each class of offense. If you start with a Class D felony, for example, you'll see that the first offense recommended presumptive term is 1, the second is 2, and the third is 3. And that as a result of the formula for factors in aggravation and mitigation, it means it can go from on a first from 0 to 2, on a second from 0 to 4, and on a third from 0 to 6, all of which gives you an acceleration factor between the levels of offense of 0. If you move to a Class C felony, you have an acceleration factor mathematically of 1/2 to a Class B felony of 1 and to a Class A felony of 2. It works out that way, just the way it's worked here, which means that it has some internal symmetry. There is a provision here which is obviously controversial. Section 36, which is the section that applies to misdemeanors, establishes a presumptive sentencing scheme for certain Class A misdemeanors, and they're listed. And they're basically attempted Class D felonies and the assault, sexual assault misdemeanor provisions. And the presumptive sentence that's recommended is a range of 90 to 80 days. That again is subject to adjustment for factors in aggravation and mitigation.
Yeah. And if you go 50 below or 100% above.
Right, as long as it's 3 years or less. So if it's more than 3 years, what I'm recommending, because of the fact, in response again to Mr. Miles' question, that the presumptive terms for some of these offenses have been lowered for, I think, good reason. I've recommended that if the presumptive term set here is more than 3 years, which are the more serious offenses, as I think you'll see, that aggravation be in an amount equal to, up to an amount equal to the presumptive term, but the mitigation only be down to an amount equal to 50% of the presumptive term. And that's what gives you this acceleration coefficient that I tried to run through real quickly here.
Just let me be sure of this. Okay. On page 6, line 22, for a second class B felony, 10 years. Okay, that effectively means 5 to 20.
That effectively means 5 to 20.
Okay, and just comparing it to the bill, that in the bill we said, this is what you have is a B in your bill.
I was auditioning the B in the last year.
The bulk of A.
Is an A. And we had, in the bill, we had 7 to 11. Uh-huh. And so you just increased the sentence twice. Like the maximum sentence by double.
Yeah.
You doubled it.
Well,
no,
sure.
No, Barry. Yeah. Because, see, we had 7 to 11, but that didn't consider aggravation.
That wasn't aggravation.
Okay.
20 is your aggravated.
Okay, then the aggravated.
Your aggravated second B.
Okay. And the aggravated, just what I'm just kind of.
Now, I understood from Doug and that you had made a tentative decision to define someone as a second offender if he'd been convicted of any prior felony.
That's yet to be voted on.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to vote on that.
This bill does not do that, and I think there are real dangers in doing that. And I realize that you would want to do it as a compromise position between not including first offenders, because you would pull in arguably a higher percentage of all felony offenders by doing so. But I think there are real basic problems of fairness of treating someone as a second offender.
Really easy way to deal with it. The same way you dealt with it. Just allow this mitigation.
Aggravation.
You allowed it as aggravation, right?
Yeah.
In the original bill, we could allow it as mitigation. You know, the fact that you committed a prior C instead of a prior A would be mitigation.
Okay, I guess I never thought of having been convicted of a prior felony as being
mitigation.
A factor.
Well, notice what kind of crime you committed, you know, that it was a less serious offense, because we already allowed the fact that your previous offense was a very serious offense to be aggravated.
That it's the type of thing that sounds okay, just sort of running off the top of your head, but you'd want to sit down and calculate it out as to what it really meant.
At least admit it's a good idea.
Okay. In any event, misdemeanors for presumptive sentencing provisions apply only to those offenses I indicated, and they don't distinguish between priors. It's just one for 90 to 180-day range there. And they have the same escape hatch in subsection D on page 8, top of page 8, line 6, as applies to felony offenses.
Has anyone ever applied presumptive misdemeanors?
I mean, I don't know. In these four I wrote what I think is a good bill that makes sense in Alaska. I don't know what they did in Maine or California or anything else. Section 43A of the bill reinserts, and that's on page 8, reinserts language that was in 297 and I think was deleted in the drafts you've been considering, which makes it clear that the presumptive sentences that are imposed under this chapter, after you take into consideration factors in aggravation, and after you take into consideration what a judge is allowed to do under what I call the escape clauses, are mandatory sentences. Once you mitigate it down, and if you're left with something more than zero, then I think you need this language, which says that you can't suspend it, you can't put it in SIS, and it can't be otherwise reduced. In this language we had put in the bill last year.
Well, wait a minute, isn't that in our current bill as to the repeat?
As I recall, I didn't see it in
297 is the repeat guide, isn't it?
What's that?
That is, you can't suspend and so forth. I thought it was there.
Doug? It says in the current bill, shall be sentenced subject to adjustment as provided.
Right.
The question is how many times have
you been? I think the lesson of speeds and
regardless of what the damage is involved, if the vehicle has the value limits that are built into the theft statute, 550, if it's of those values, then it fits those crimes, and that it would only be a felony if the value of the vehicle tampered with is over $500. I notice in here, for example, that you're creating a felony offense on someone who has a vehicle under an agreement. I have Barry's car. He loans it to me to use for a week to drive around here in Juneau. I take it and split the Fairbanks with it with the intention of going for 2 weeks and coming back and giving it back to him. That's a felony offense. I'm not sure you really want to do that. And I don't think that, I've never thought that as a prosecutorial policy matter, that the concept of joyriding, independent from other criminal mischief offenses, makes any sense. An automobile is like anything else that's tampered with. And I think it can be dealt with in the criminal mischief sections, making it a felony if the value of the car is over $500, making it a class A misdemeanor.